All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am very excited to welcome you to our fourth session of our wonderful course called Wrestling with Faith. I will tell you that although it's session number four, we are actually studying lesson number three. The reason is because we've done the sessions out of order, out of the original order. In the aftermath of what happened in Pittsburgh, we did lesson four, which speaks about responding to pain, suffering, and tragedy. So this is lesson three, and I want to begin with a story. There was a busload of tourists that arrived in England at a very famous place, the place where the Magna Carta was signed, and the tour guide is telling the group that this is where the Magna Carta was signed, and where this great document happened. And a fellow in the crowd in the tour says, when was it signed? The tour guide says, 12:15. The fellow says, just missed it. Just missed it. All right. Welcome back. Yeah, right? Whew. It's time for a joke. So today we're going to look at, the topic today is called A Higher Paradigm, Understanding Torah Law in Light of Our Modern Sensibilities. It's an important topic, and here's how I want to lead into it. Good morning, or good afternoon. So here's how I want to lead into it. We've established thus far in this series two major ideas. Idea number one is about God. And we define, now God is, God can't be defined, but that's exactly what we said in lesson one. We said that God is, to the best of our expression, God is the undefined, underlying reality of all. That's what we know. We can't define God, like put God into a box, right? Not going to work. So you can't put God into a box, but what we can say about God is that God is undefined. That's not a definition. That's literally saying undefined. But underlying reality. God just is and is the core of all reality. That's what we established in the first session, in lesson one. In lesson number two, which we covered last week, we talked about the fact that what is a mitzvah? We said a mitzvah is not necessarily a good deed, because not all mitzvot feel good. And a mitzvah is not, although it's a commandment, but there's a better definition for mitzvah. A mitzvah is something that has been given to us to better ourselves. And we discuss this on four different levels. It can benefit us in the long term. It can benefit us in the short term. It can benefit us vis-a-vis our relationship with God. And it can also give us the greatest gift, the gift of accomplishing a mission, the gift of a sense of purpose and meaning, and living an altruistic life. So a mitzvah gives so much to us. So lesson one, we spoke about God. Lesson two, about Torah and mitzvot. So now we have lesson three. Four session, but lesson number three. And in lesson three, we dig a little bit deeper. Because when you dig a little deeper into Torah law, and traditional Jewish practice, there is a lot that might perplex us. There's a lot that might confound us. In other words, let's speak very honestly and frankly here. There's a certain modern sensibility that we have here in the United States. There's certain values. Now, I can't say that everyone believes in these modern values, but I think a lot of us do. And we hold these values very dear. And we feel like these are maybe progressive, or maybe as human beings and societies and civilizations and governments and whatever, as they've evolved and progressed, we're at a certain place right now where we have things that we believe in and things that we stand for and things that we won't stand for, etc. As a people, as human beings. The question is, when you look at Torah and Jewish law, there are certain elements of either Jewish practice or Jewish belief and the ethos of Judaism that don't seem to be current, that don't seem to be modern. And the core tension of today's class is going to be, how do we reconcile? How do we understand? How do we put into context ancient Jewish law, Torah law, with our modern sensibilities. In other words, this course is entitled Wrestling with Faith, and that means that there's tension in our lives, tension that might hold us back from fully embracing God or Judaism or Torah, etc. So what is today's challenge that we're going to try to deal with? The challenge of looking at Judaism, looking at Torah law and saying, you know, it seems a little bit outdated. It seems a little bit out of touch. How can I fully get behind this if you're stuck 3,000 years ago or maybe even 200 years ago? Make sense? So just to state it very succinctly, the objective of today's lesson is to better understand Torah law in relation to our modern sensibilities. It's going to be a tall order. It's going to be a tall task. It's an ambitious course in general, and I'm excited to embark on this journey together with you. One thing I'll mention right at the outset, and this is an important point to mention, is that as we present the two systems of values, and we're going to do this, we're going to talk about two value systems, a modern value system and a Torah value system. As we explore these two very different value systems, the goal and the objective of today's class is not to promote one over the other. It's not to say, well, this one's better, or this one's worse, or this one has... That's not going to be the objective. The objective is to understand the value of each value system in its space. Because by understanding the value of each in its space, both can actually coincide and coexist, even when it doesn't seem possible. In other words, sometimes we feel like it's a zero-sum game. And if you have two things that seem contradictory, one has to win and one will definitely lose. Today, we're going to think a little bit differently. It's not about winning or losing. It's not about right or wrong. It's not about better or worse. It's not about ranking one value system against another. It's understanding the value of each on its own and how, indeed, in our lives, they can actually coexist and complement each other in an incredible way. Make sense? Okay, that's all the introduction. So let's jump in. And I want you to tell me the areas of Jewish law, of Torah law, of traditional Torah law that you think might push up against our modern sensibilities. So I've laid out a general notion that there are things that seem maybe contradictory, it seem, you know, out of touch or out of date. But I want you now to work with your table mates and come up with a few ideas. Bert, you can you can long distance it.
You can do it.
Yeah. Remember MTC? Who remembers MTC? The phone company? Was that MTC? AT&T, but there was another one. Oh, MCI. Yeah. Was it MCI? Yeah. MTC is the Montreal Torah Center. That's something totally different. That's actually a legit thing. What was it? What did I say it was? MCI. Remember that? What happened to them? Who knows? That's for the lesson 7 of this series, which does not yet exist. So, again, work with your table mates and start discussing areas of Torah law that seem a little bit out of touch. I'm going to give you 90 seconds to 2 minutes. Please begin. Lolly, hey, did you get a book?
Huh?
Did you get a book?
No.
You should get a book.
Yeah.
Why don't you have a book? Remember, question on the table is, what areas of Torah law can you think of that appear or feel out of date? All right, folks, let's pick it up together. I want to know, I am curious. All right, folks, I'm curious as to what you came up with together with your neighbors, so to speak. All right, anybody share with me what you came up with? What you got?
Okay, so we came up with several things.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing that we both agreed on is the separation, some of the laws that seem very paternalistic to us. For example, not being, I really needed a hug from you a couple weeks ago. And I mean that non-contact and
right.
separation during worship.
Right. Okay.
And men and women and some of the other.
So gender separation, that sort of thing. Okay, good. What else? Okay, thank you. What else? What else did you have?
We had.
Give me the next one more. One more that you came up with.
One more was the slavery. The fact that.
Well, I talked about how the Bible talked about slavery in not a negative way.
Right.
The human rights
thing. Right. Oh, human rights. Yeah, what's up with that? Okay, good. Yeah.
We had a question about charging interest. Isn't there a
prohibition?
Prohibition, yeah. That says you shouldn't charge or benefit
yeah.
from interest.
Yes.
And yet that seems to be commonplace.
Yeah. What's up with that?
It's like a question. And then
yeah.
we talked about.
I call that an interesting question. Interesting.
But then we talked about why is it still not allowed to eat pork? Originally, it was because of the disease trichinosis, but now we know how to cook it properly. So that's what.
So eating. So question, food, culinary questions as well. Okay. By the way, have I mentioned that we're doing a course called Jews and Food starting in January? Yeah. Join us, 4-part series. Okay. Good. Thank you. Yeah.
We talked about kashrut also.
Okay. Right.
When I was growing up in New York, a blue law saying you couldn't have a store open even on Sunday.
Right.
It's very difficult for the Jewish merchants. On Saturday, and then on Sunday also, then weekends were the busiest time.
Right. I'm pretty sure that the reason why the Jewish Bible says Saturday is simply to allow for NFL Sunday to be a thing. That just opens that door very, very, very easily. But right, so Shabbat-related questions, point very well taken. What else? What other? Yeah. Oh, the kaparis, yeah. Listen. The old chicken twirl around the head is always a fan favorite. Do you guys know what that is? There's a custom, but that's a custom. That's a tradition. That's not Torah law. That's not a biblical law. So although it's an interesting custom, yeah. You know, some of my kids are hesitant, and I'm like, "What are you, chicken?" I'm joking. That never happened. I just felt like I should say that. Yes.
So most of the law Shabbat, not turning on the light.
Right. Right, what's up with that? Just a little thing where you can schlep a whole cache, but you can't hit a switch? You can't even say, "Alexa, turn on the lights." Well, since when does Alexa have to keep Shabbat? Like, what's up with that? I didn't do anything. I just told her to do it. All right, if she's a her, yeah.
We also talked about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, go.
We talked about Shabbat prohibitions and driving. In modern times, many Jews aren't necessarily living right here. Walking.
Right. Right. In ancient times, you were probably right next door in the shtetl right there. But now we're spread out, so it makes it difficult to go to synagogue if you're living out. Good. Lolly.
Matrimonial identity, Jewish identity, and that we should be married. Ushpizin.
On Sukkot?
No, she's talking about
Oh, the upshare. Oh, why the haircut? Okay, that's also a custom. But let's talk about matrilineal descent for a second. Somebody asked me, actually, when we did this exercise Tuesday night, somebody framed your question like this. If we know about DNA testing. Like, sorry, not if we know. Oh, was that the premise of it? Yeah, like DNA testing, we can figure this out. Maybe back in the day, the safest bet to know a child's identity is to know the mother, but today we have other ways to know. So it's a good question. Good. What else? We'll do one more, yeah.
I don't know if this is Torah law. What about women and get?
Women and get, yes. So it seems like it's very difficult because the man has to give the Jewish bill of divorce and that can create difficult scenarios. That's a great question. Okay. So what we see here is that there are elements.
Is that religious or that?
Yeah, the Torah says that. Yeah, 100%. That's not custom, that's biblical. Yeah. That's straight up derived from the verse that says that he gives her the writ of divorce. Yeah. So these are great questions. I want to frame our discussion, although I think that at the end of our conversation, we're going to in some way touch on, not directly, but and not super indirectly, but we're going to touch on, we're going to address all of the areas that have, most of the areas of queer that have been raised. But I want to focus our conversation on three specific areas that I think are fairly hot button topics. So the first area, and you can see this, there's an exercise here that's in the book that kind of mentions these points. But the first area is egalitarianism. We live in a very egalitarian society. We live in a nation, in a culture, in a civilization where egalitarianism is a good thing and understood to be a good thing. And Judaism doesn't always seem to be, at least traditional Judaism and Torah law, doesn't always seem to propose that type of equality. In fact, Torah law talks about differences between genders, differences between various tribes of the Jewish people, differences between religions and responsibilities. So Judaism speaks of not peoples being equal, but people being different. So that's one area in which, a general area in which there's a little bit of conflict or perhaps tension. Then we have, along those lines, we have different social roles amongst those different groups. So Torah law, specifically, specifies differences, different roles, even when it comes to obligations of mitzvot between genders and between various tribes. You know, within the Jewish people themselves, there are Kohanim, Leviim, and Yisraelim. There are the Kohen, there are the Kohanim, the priests, the Levites, and the regular Jews. Right, the regular Yisraelim, right, the regular Israelites. So if you walk into most synagogues around the world and you go for a Torah reading, the first person to get called up to the Torah will likely be from the priestly family, from a Kohen. And the second will be a Levite. And the third and subsequent will be from the general Israelites from the other tribes. And what we find here, then, this is just one small example, but we see that there are different roles based on differences amongst the Jewish people. And of course, Torah law also specifies differences amongst nations. Jews have 613 mitzvot. The rest of the world has 7. You know the company 7 for All Mankind?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Wow. Where do you think the name comes from? 7 for All Mankind. Straight up. Right? All my denim I get from there. I don't have a lot of denim, but if I did. Anyway, 7 for All Mankind, I think it's a French company. Right? So 613, and you might think, wow, that's a big difference in numbers. And yeah, you're right. It's a huge difference in numbers. It's like 606 or so difference. Anyway, so you have different roles, and we live in a world that promotes equality and promotes, you know, in a sense, certain sense, an element of sameness and the ability to that there shouldn't be distinctions in roles, and Torah law does specify distinction. The third element that we're going to focus on, at least directly here, is the idea of choice, personal choice. We live at a time when personal choice is a big thing. We live in a time when the idea of personal choice is promoted as a very strong value, and choosing on many different levels. In fact, we may have mentioned this at a previous class, or maybe not. There's a fellow from Europe, I forget which country, who actually went in front of the court the local courts recently who said he wants to change his age. You saw this? This is legit. You saw this? Hell, yeah. He wants to change his age. He is now 69, and he wants to be 49, legally on the books. He says he can't get a mortgage at 69. He can't. He has having difficult dating. Now he's married. It doesn't matter. He says he can't. He's having difficult. Look it up. He's having difficult. He doesn't want to lie. Right? What's the option? To lie about his age? Why should he lie about his age? But he feels 49, and he's in great shape, and he feels young. Why can't he choose to legally change his age? And he'll forego government benefits of his country. I'll forego the benefits if I could turn back time. Right? Let's go back to 49. And that's it. Call it two decades.
Is he at 49
or is he... No. I think he's going to do a reset to 49 and then go. And then when he hits 69 again, who knows? Who knows? The sky's the limit. And the judge there is seriously considering it. Oh, it's Dutch. It's right. It is Dutch. Yeah. Okay. So listen, it is what it is. But we live in at a time when personal choice is put up. It's promoted as a good thing. In Judaism, traditional Judaism, you may not have that same thing. In fact, you know, you can look. Judaism talks about roles, and it talks about. The notion of choice is not something you find in Torah. Torah does not talk about choice. It doesn't say, with regards to the Ten Commandments, okay, here's a bunch of ideas. Choose which one you like. Best out of 10. Multiple choice. You know, it's you have to do this, you can't do that, and that's it. Torah doesn't speak in terms of choice. It doesn't speak of, you know, you can choose to honor your parents. You can choose to not murder. You can choose to not steal. You can choose to respect family. That's not what it says. It says you must. You ought to, and you should never. It doesn't talk about choice. So how does Torah, values, ethos, the whole system fit in with how we live today? If it's outdated, then it's going to be hard to relate to, and it's going to be hard to embrace, and that's something we might wrestle with. The goal of today, like I said at the opening, is to explain each system in its context. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to start first with our modern value system and discuss how we got to where we are today with the notion of egalitarianism and the social roles not being so super defined and personal choice being promoted, right? How did we get to that value system here today? And then how did Torah law evolve and emerge? And once we understand that, we'll have a much better understanding how both systems can actually coexist side by side, even when it doesn't seem possible as of yet. Okay, so let's jump in. If we had to look at many of the social movements that exist today, and you can come up with your own list of social movements, but we all know various social movements, progressive movements, egalitarian mystic, if that's the way to phrase it, movements, choice movements, etc. What drives many, most, perhaps all of those movements, the core value that drives perhaps all of these movements is the notion of human rights. The notion of human rights drives so many of our modern movements: race equality, egalitarianism, feminism, gender equality, non-gender conforming advocacy, etc. All of them and more are driven by a very basic, fundamental, essential notion of human rights. The question is, where does the notion of human rights come from in the first place? Right, human rights is driving where we are today. Where does the notion of human rights come from? In fact, if you look back in ancient writings, you will likely not find any discussion of human rights. You open up the Bible, you open up the Torah does not speak of human rights. Now, there's been a lot of discussion. Much ink has been spilled, or whatever, much ink has been written on the topic of how human rights are derived from the Torah, from the Bible. But again, look at the Torah. Look at the Ten Commandments. The Torah does not say parents have a right to be honored. That's not what it says. And it doesn't say an individual has a right to their life. And it doesn't say human beings have a right to keep their property. It doesn't speak in terms of rights and human rights. It speaks in a different language altogether. It says, you must honor your parents. You cannot murder. You cannot steal, etc. That's the language of the Torah. The Torah does not speak in terms of human rights. So where does this notion of human rights come from? Again, you can derive it indirectly or maybe somewhat, you know, directly from the Torah, from the Bible. Because if children should honor parents, that might mean that parents have a right to be honored. Maybe. You could say that. I don't know if that's a slam dunk argument. You know, I don't know if that's a logical, if that needs to be a logical inference. Nonetheless, one could say that. However, where is the first articulation of human rights as a thing unto itself, as a value unto itself? According to most historians and experts, the first appearance of this is the Magna Carta. Take this, and again, we now know what time, when it was signed. When was it signed, of course? 1215. You'll probably remember that at least till the end of this class. Now, 1215, what is going on? This happens in England. There's the king of the time is King John of England. He is a fellow that people are not so keen on. People don't like him. The barons don't like him. The commoners don't like him. He's a king that's not so, shall we say, kosher. And he has some military setbacks, and with that he loses even more popularity. And at this point, he is being threatened. His entire sovereignty is being threatened. And the barons especially, they tell him, look, you need to sign a document that gives people their rights, and if you don't, we're going to get rid of you altogether. Here's the document. What does he do? He signs it. Take a look at text number one. Here's an excerpt from the document's introduction. Mark Galt, will you please get us started? Page 69, text number one. Magna Carta excerpt, do you have a...
What I'm looking for. I'm going to phone before I
went. Yeah. Is, page shoot it. While you're talking, page shoot it. Yeah.
69.
What I was looking for was the source for man is endowed with certain inalienable rights. I was trying to see what...
It's the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, but where does it come from? That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Okay.
This is what we're talking about today. You are so on topic. All right. Text one. Go ahead.
To all free men of our kingdom, we have also granted for us and our heirs forever all the liberties written up below to have and to keep for them and their heirs of us and our heirs.
Yeah, there's a lot of legal speak there, right? Of us and our heirs, of us and their heirs, blah, blah, blah. Bottom line is, it's being written from the perspective of the monarchy. This is the way it's understood. I know it's an excerpt and it might not be clear from that, but trust me on this. It's written from the perspective of the monarchy. The monarchy is saying that we... The royal we, literally the royal we, the royal we are granting all free men of our kingdom, we're granting certain liberties. This is the first articulation of human rights. Now, the Magna Carta, by the way, was not in legal effect for long. Things changed on the ground and it kind of went out of legal effect. Nonetheless, throughout English history, throughout English history, when things got difficult, the people would point to the Magna Carta as establishing the fundamentals of certain liberties and freedoms of the people, certain rights of the people. We are all more familiar with a similar document, which was penned 560 years later in Independence Hall. At least it was signed in Independence Hall in Philadelphia on July 4th of 1776. Let's read that. Catherine, please read text number 2, page 69.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
So here we go. Well, don't turn the page yet, because we need to focus on this. Declaration of Independence says that these are truths that are self-evident. We all have, we're all created equal. We have certain unalienable rights. Amongst them, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. How would you compare text 1 to text 2, the Magna Carta statement, versus the Declaration of Independence? Which do you think is more sweeping? Which do you think is more daring? Which is more limited, etc.? What do you think?
Well, I think they should have changed one word in the Declaration of Independence.
Men?
Yeah. They just said people.
Yeah.
It would have changed a lot of things in this country and all over the world.
Okay.
But they meant
all white land owning men. That's what they meant.
Once you wrote it, we're slave owners.
Right. Okay.
No, that was a conscious intent. It was that
the
use of men there meant mankind.
I think it did mean mankind.
Right.
And I do think the intention was that people are created equal. But again, you might say that all people are created equal, but some are more equal than others, right? Famous line from, okay. What else? What else do you see? If you compare and contrast, text, yeah.
The Magna Carta, it's who's granting these liberties, it's the monarchy.
Yes. Yes.
And that's where its source is, whereas in the Declaration of Independence, it's two things. It's self-evident, which, whenever somebody says, well, obviously this is the case, you should get suspicious.
Right. How do we know this?
Exactly.
Why is it so obvious?
You need to ask.
Right.
But it's self-evident, but it's also that the source of the liberties is endowed by the Creator.
Yes.
The rights are from the Creator, so it's very different than having a being.
And that's the core idea that I wanted to get to, and that's beautifully stated. In other words, the Magna Carta text 1 in 1215, right? The Magna Carta says it's the monarchy that has the power. And they saw themselves as the divine, divinely granted power, divine right of kings, etc. They saw themselves as representatives of the divine. And they said, okay, out of the kindness of our heart or under duress, whatever it is, we're going to grant some of our freedoms and rights to others as we see fit, but it's coming from them. In the formulation of the Declaration of Independence, and again, of course, whenever we discuss the events of 1776, we're going to push up against the realities on the ground that don't seem to be in concert with that very Declaration of Independence. Nonetheless, in its written articulation, if we understand men to mean people, right? If we understand that, then what is the statement at its core? It's that human beings are all created equal, endowed rights, not by us, but by our Creator. In others, they're inherent, they're essential, they're not man-made, thus they cannot be man-revoked. If human beings are not the ones granting it, human beings cannot be the ones revoking it. This becomes the core tenet, the core value, the core operating instruction, if you will, for our nation. America is founded very, very strongly on this core idea, and that is that human beings are created equal, endowed with rights, have a certain value that cannot be taken away. It's not man-made. It cannot be taken away. And it's very different than Magna Carta. It grants certain rights, but it's because we're being nice, so we're giving you certain rights. We can always revoke it. It's going to be limited. This is more essential. Was it perfect then? Of course not. Is it perfect today? Of course not. But that's, at least in its written formulation, what it's trying to achieve. Now, the question then becomes, what is the role of government? You didn't think you were walking in today for a class on government, but this is happening right now. What is then the role of government? If people are free and people have essential liberty, so let people live together and do their thing freely, why is there some sort of hierarchy in the United States? Why is there a concept of government in the first place? So, we have one of the great thinkers of the time, Thomas Paine, one of America's founding fathers, who explains in text 3a and text 3b, I'll give you the kitzer, in Hebrew, you know what kitzer is? I'll give you the summary. The short version. The short version of 3a and 3b, and we can read it inside perhaps. The short piece of it is government is not an ideal. The ideal is that free people live freely and do their own thing. Form societies, benefit each other, mazel tov, enjoy. But what happens inevitably? Inevitably, people don't behave. And people living freely, left to their own devices, seek to harm others. But why? I don't know. That's just the way it is sometimes, unfortunately. And thus you need certain governing bodies that make sure that the rights of all the members are being protected. Are you with me? In a situation where societies form, and some members of this free society wish to take advantage or harm or have harmed other members of the society, to protect those that have been harmed, or those that are being impinged on, to protect their rights, that's the role of government, at least in the formulation of one of the founding fathers, Thomas Paine, and many agree with this formulation. In other words, government is a necessary evil. Why is it evil? Because it's taking away, necessarily, it's taking away some rights and liberties of the individual. But it's necessary to protect the rights of others. You should know. Has anybody ever ridden a motorcycle?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. Have you ever worn a helmet while riding a motorcycle?
No. Not when I was 22 years old.
Okay. Tell us more. All right. But here's, I'm glad that you're still you're still here and still good. Here's the deal. I believe it was in the 1960s. Trying to remember when it happened. All right, fine. Before my time. But in the 1960s, so the United States was trying to get, the federal government was trying to get the motorcycle helmet laws passed. But it had to be passed by the states. And a lot of states were pushing back. So the government said that, you know what, here's the deal. You either pass it or we're going to cut funding to your state. So you have a choice, right? But that's it. Then you had lawsuits. People sued the states. And they sued, it happened in Illinois and other states. They said, I'll use more Hebrew. Why not? It's fun. Hayitachin, how dare you? How dare you tell me that riding my own personal motorcycle, I need to wear a helmet? Who are you, government, to tell me what to do? If I choose to ride my motorcycle that I own without a helmet, so be it. And I went to the courts. And you know what some courts explain? Why do you have to wear? Why does the government have a right to tell you what to do with your own head? Number one, yeah. If you get injured, then we're gonna have to take care of you.
Or you could cause a wreck.
Or you could cause a wreck, and that's impinging on the liberty and life of others in our free society. And we have to send out crews and ambulances and fire and shut down highways and clean up spills, and we don't want to be involved in that.
Same thing with
seatbelt. Yeah, seatbelt law is the same deal, right? Similar, but anyway, the point is like this, that at its core, our society, our nation is founded on the notion of human rights and personal liberty, essential liberty. The government is only meant by design to get involved when it's protecting those very rights. Now, the question that divides the parties, etc., and this is not, we're not going to get into a political discussion here. I'm just going to mention this and then quickly, deftly walk out of that discussion, is where do you draw that line? Oftentimes the question is, where do you draw the line of the necessity of the government to step in? And some will say, now we need to step in, the government needs to step in. And some say, no, let it keep on going, and only then step in. So the question is, where do you draw the line? That's an arbitrary decision or consideration. That's up to whoever it is to decide. And that's where you have that variance of positions and how big should government be, how small should government be, etc. Again, it's not about getting into any specific issues or whatever it is. The point is that this is a framework. This is a framework. Let's read. I want to just read one of these texts. Hal, please read. Let's read 3a, page 70.
Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins. Society is produced by its own wants and government. Own wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by igniting our affections, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. Government, like dress, is a badge of lost innocence. The palaces of kings are built upon the ruins of the bowers and bowers of paradise. Were the impulses of consciousness clear, uniform, and irresistible, obeyed, men would need no longer to have lawgivers.
Thank you. In other words, what's he saying? He's saying that societies, free societies, founded and propagated by free people is fantastic. Everyone has their freedoms, their rights, and everyone's living together. Kumbaya, baby, it's a party. But what happens inevitably? Someone's trying to take advantage of someone else. Inevitably, people end up trying to harm someone else. And therefore, government like dress, I like that line. It's a reference to obviously the sin of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, where after the sin, so now Adam and Eve, out of their embarrassment, now they put on some clothing. Government like dress is a badge of lost innocence. Had things worked nicely, we wouldn't need this other body. We wouldn't need these laws. But if you can't get along on your own, that's it. We're going to step in with rules. It's like when you let your kids play and everything's fine. No problem. No need for parental oversight. But once now there's conflict and there's fighting over a toy, all right, you get 5 minutes and you get 5 minutes. But what about freedom, human rights? Okay, if you can get along on your own, mazel tov. Does this make sense? Yes. This is really important because it leads necessarily to the next pieces of it, which is also stated, not surprisingly, in the very same core United States document signed on July 4th, 1776, known as the Declaration of Independence. Listen to this, text 4a. In other words, you can't understand 4a and 4b without the hakdama, without the introduction that I just gave you. Ronnie, please read text 4a.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government.
Understanding that at the core, we are a society comprised of people, human beings who are essentially free, granted God-given liberties. So, the role of government only exists to secure these rights and liberties. And where does government get its power?
The people.
From the governed, from the consent of the governed, from the people. There is no aristocracy, there is no monarchy. This is not England. This is not King John's times. This is not King John saying, I will grant you some of my liberty as I see fit. No, this is us being essentially free and us consenting to a system of law to protect ourselves. Yes? Make sense? It follows necessarily what's stated in text 4b. Tell me what we just read. What just was stated?
Government doesn't work. Get rid of it.
People have two options. Number one, what are the two phrases here? Number one,
alter.
Number two, abolish. Get rid of it altogether. In other words, government does not have its own power. Government does not have divine rights. Doesn't exist. People have divine rights. People have divine liberties. Government only works. Not works. Government only exists based on the consent of the people. So if people don't like the government, change it. And if you really don't like it, abolish it. You with me so far? So here's what we've this is all very important because we're going to contract. I think I mentioned this as we're kind of framing our discussion, but all of this is going to be positioned in stark contrast with every element of Torah law. And you'll see one by one, it's totally different. But what are the points that we've discovered so far about American values and law? Number one, America, the United States, at its core document, believes that people are inherently and divinely free, that people should ideally live together in societies that are likewise free, that protect that benefit all members of that society. When needed, however, government the people can vote in or put up a government that protects its members' rights, and if people feel the government is not serving its correct purpose, they can either alter or abolish it. Now let's look at the origins of Torah law, and you will see how this is completely different.
Is that a quick question?
Sure. They have their own Declaration of Independence, their own constitution. I haven't studied it. It's been a little while since I've looked at it. I haven't even studied it on a scholarly level. It's a good question. My understanding is it's based more on Western values than Torah values, which we'll discuss in a moment. What are the origins of Torah law? Yeah, but how does the story play out? So let's go back to Egypt. Jews love going back to Egypt. It's like, oh, do you remember when we built those pyramids? Oh, man. Look, I haven't built anything in 3,000 years, but look at those pyramids, right? I walk into a hardware store, I have no idea even, right? I don't even know where to look sometimes, but we built those pyramids, baby. Look at that. Anyway, but we love going back to Egypt. So we were in Egypt. Remember that? Back in the day, we talk about it twice a day in the Shema prayer. We talk about it every Passover. We relive it. I mean, the only thing we're missing is like sand at our seders. We got the food, but we're all eating that matzah. And sometimes you don't know if you're eating the matzah or the box, right? You've had that experience. My wife tells me that growing up in South Africa, there was a guest at her table. You know how there's a part of the seder where traditionally you eat the sandwich? So you take matzah and then you put your romaine lettuce in there. You put a little spicy horseradish in there. First of all, how good does it sound? I mean, this is amazing. And back in the day when there was a temple, they put a piece of meat in there. If you're a meat eater, if you're a carnivore, this is the original sandwich. I mean, this is what you got. You got like, it's flanked by some sort of bread, carb item. You have the vegetable. You have the meat. You have spice.
And fruit.
What are you missing?
Fruit. You got fruit and wine, too.
Yeah, but that, right. It's a party. Anyway, so here's the story. So this person was holding a napkin underneath the sandwich so that, you know, the pieces shouldn't fall out and make the table all messy. At the end of the sandwich, this person unfolded their napkin and there was a hole in the napkin. And the point is like this, you would never know because the matzah might taste, you know, kind of starchy like the napkin. It is what it is. But let's get back to Egypt. So we were slaves for a few hundred years. Then we get out of slavery. Thank you, Moses and God, of course. And we cross the sea. And we count 49 days, and on the 50th day, we stand at Mount Sinai. And there, God gives us Torah law. God gives us the Bible. Originally, the first iteration of this is the Ten Commandments. Then Moses goes up the mountain, comes back 40 days later with the tablets of the law, and the rest of the Torah, and of course, the people are dancing the horror around the golden calf, and Moses breaks the tablets, whatever. Anyway, God says, look, this is the law, these are the laws, and that happens at Mount Sinai. Good. So I'll ask you a question. Did the people leading up, the events leading up to Mount Sinai, were the people looking forward to receiving the law? Yes or no? What do you think? Did they consent to receive the Torah?
Yes.
Yes. Why do you say yes? And what do they say?
We will take it and then we'll learn.
Look at you quoting scripture.
Incredible.
Look at you. See that motorcycle? Nothing happened. Without the helmet? No problem. Let's take a look at this. Text number 5. Bird is 100% right. Text number 5. Maya, please take it away.
Moses took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They said, all that God has instructed, we will follow and we will learn.
This is before Sinai. Moses says, hey, God wants to give you a book of tons of laws. Do you want it? Here's a sample. Here's a teaser. Do you want it? The people said, yeah, Naseh v'nishma. We'll do and we'll... Yeah, we're in. Tell us about it later, but we're in. And then God says to Moses, perfect. Take 2 tablets and call me in the morning. All right, fine. Good. So what happens? The people consent. Fantastic. Let's keep on reading the narrative. Text number 6. Ronnie.
On the morning of the third day, there were
was thunderclaps and lightning flashes, and the cloud hovered over the mountain. There was a deafening blast of the shofar. The entire nation that was in the camp shuddered. Moses led the people out of the camp to meet God. They stood at the bottom of the mountain. The Sinai was completely covered by smoke because God had descended upon it from the fire. The smoke ascended and like the smoke of the kiln. The entire mountain quaked violently.
Okay, so here we have some of the special effects of Mount Sinai. There's quaking, there's smoking, there's fire.
So far,
so good. There's all this stuff going on. People are shuddering. It's very dramatic. But there's a very interesting verse that the Talmud points out and explains. The verse, it totally would go unnoticed otherwise. In the Hebrew, maybe it's a little bit more noticed. But it's the verse where it says, it talks about the people standing at the bottom of the mountain. In the Hebrew, it says, "Vayisyatzvu betachtis ahar," that the people stood literally under the mountain. Under the mountain. And the Talmud says, this tells us something important. Text number 7. Andrea, please read this one. 75.
These words teach us that God held the mountain over the Jews like a barrel. God said to them, if you accept my Torah, then it is good. If you don't, this will be your burial place.
Characterize, if you will, God's statement to the Jewish people, holding a mountain over their heads like a barrel. I don't know who holds a barrel, but whatever. Characterize, how would you characterize God's statement?
Threatening.
It's kind of a threat, right? Is it a threat or a promise? Yeah, it's kind of both, right? God is saying, either accept the Torah or, in the language of the Talmud, Sham Tehei Kvuraschem. You'll be buried right here. That's happening. This is, that's it. So it's your choice. But there's a mountain being held over your head. It's like, what's that shadow? Oh, huh. Just Mount Sinai. No big deal. No biggie. Okay.
Well, they wouldn't get any farther, I guess it means. They wouldn't go to the promised.
Yeah, that would be pretty much it on all counts. So how much of a choice did we have? And I have a bunch of questions now, and I'm sure you have a bunch of questions, but here are my questions. I have really two questions. Number one, my first question is a statement. Number one, this doesn't seem very nice, does it? Oh, we ended up as a question. Look at that. This doesn't seem nice. Does it? Or doesn't it? This does not seem nice. It's rhetorical. This seems pretty mean, or cruel, or threatening. What kind of, like, what is this? That's number one. That's the first question, area of inquiry. The second question is the following. The people had already given their consent. And if you look at text 5 and text 6, you may notice that the chapters, one is later than the other, but don't be alarmed by the chapter numbers. There's a famous rule, Ein Muktam Mo'acha b'Torah. Torah is not written necessarily in chronological order. And thus, we know the chronology. Moses asked the people first, before the mountain was held over their head, do you want to take the Torah? Do you want to accept it? And the people said, Naseh v'nishma, we'll do it unconditionally, no questions asked. Tell us about it later. You'll give us the full rundown later, but we're in. Sign us up for it. God says you want, another tablet show is happening right now. God says, You want my law in written form? Absolutely. The Jews said, how much will it cost? God says, nothing. We'll take two of them. All right, there you go. So what's the point? What's the point? The people had already consented. If that's the case, then you can ask the obvious question. If there was already consent, why the threat? It wasn't even necessary. In addition to the question of, it's kind of mean and cruel and like, doesn't sound right, doesn't feel right. In addition to that, it seems totally unnecessary. The people had already consented. They'd already told Moses, we're in. Imagine, you intend on signing a contract. You meet, whatever it is. You say yes, you've agreed to it, and now you're showing up to the signing. Do you need to coerce the party? What's the coercion? What's going on here? What's with the mountain? It's like, put down the mountain. We've already said yes. You've already made the sale. What's going on here? It doesn't make sense. But here's the point. Here's the point of all of this. The point of all of this is it sets the stage for understanding how Torah unfolds. Okay. To see what I mean, let's take a look at another text. Text 8a. Let's see how Torah law plays out. Text 8a. And.
Everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall neither add to it nor subtract.
So it says in Deuteronomy, right, what does the Torah say? Everything, all Torah law, don't add to it, don't subtract from it. Rashi explains, for example, you can't add a fifth chapter of parchment or section of parchment to the tefillin, to the phylacteries. You can't add another plant to the four kinds that we shake on Sukkot. You can't detract from those either, and other mitzvot as well. In other words, don't modify the mitzvot. That's number one. Straight up Deuteronomy. Let's do 8b as well, and do one more. What does this tell us? What is the nature of Torah law? It's eternal. It's permanent. It's not going anywhere. So what do we have? So what's 8a and what's 8b? 8a tells us that you can't do what to Torah? Let's use the word of the concept of the Declaration of Independence. You cannot alter it. And text 8b tells us you cannot
abolish
it. Huh. Look at that. Looky at that. Text number 9, Rambam, Maimonides, points this out and draws the two together. Dan.
It is clear and explicit in the Torah that it is God's everlasting commandment and is not subject to change, condition, or diminishment. The Torah states, everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall neither add to it nor subtract from it. It also states,
okay, so what do we have here? We have this final line of Rambam Maimonides that says, we're commanded to fulfill all of Torah's directives in their unaltered state forever. If you combine 8a and 8b, that's the conclusion that we come to. Let's now take a moment, take just a quick moment to observe how different Torah law is from our system of law in the United States of America. Number one, let's just clearly draw out the contrast. Number one, when we talk about consent of the governed, right? The whole foundation of American law, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, is that government only operates due to the consent of the governed. Okay, and we started off with consent when it came to Jewish law, but quickly it devolved, or whatever, it morphed into no consent, where God says, accept it or die. Consent of the governed? Is there consent of the governed? Is that real? If you're under a mountain, and maybe it's shaking, it's like, oh, right? And you say yes, have you consented?
No.
Wholeheartedly? Of course not. So, U.S. law, consent of the governed. Torah law, I'm not going to call that consent. That's coercion. U.S. law, alter it. Torah law, can't alter it. American law, U.S. law, abolish it if you don't like it, if it's not working. Torah law, immutable. Remember MC Hammer? Can't touch us. Right? Can't alter it, can't abolish it. It's so very different. And this might evoke a sense of, again, wow, this is so out of touch. What's going on? It so defies and runs against our every sensibility of what a law, of what government, but what a form, a structure should look like. Yeah.
Well, also, you said not nice. I mean, it depicts a God that's pretty authoritarian.
Yeah.
Difficult to love that God.
Yeah. But let's leave God out of it for a second. I'm just joking. But yeah, you're right. It seems like now this whole thing leaves a bad taste in our mouths. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Good. So, we're at a bit of a crossroads. The questions are mounting. Right? In addition to some of the details of Torah law not aligning with our sensibilities, like we discussed all the way at the opening, and you know, when we all discussed this together, we're left wondering, why did God force the law on the people? Why can't Torah law be amended, and why can't it be abolished if necessary? What's this business? And so, hold the questions for a second, because I want to just advance this to the next stage, and then if there's anything, we can certainly discuss the questions soon. So, how to understand Torah law? Remember, the goal, the objective, as I stated already earlier, the objective is not to position one system as better, one system as better or worse than the other, but to understand each system in its place and fulfilling its purpose. And therefore, we're trying to put each one in context. And to help us understand the context, the full context of Torah law, we need to look at an incredible teaching of the Maharal of Prague, who explains this Talmudic depiction of God lifting up the mountain over the heads of the Jewish people. In text number 10, on page 79, the Maharal of Prague is explaining what was God thinking, what was God doing when he lifted the mountain over our heads. This is going to be the turning point. This is going to be the key to unlocking an understanding of what the role and the context and the purpose of Torah law is that will make everything understandable and fall into place. This is from the Maharal of Prague. Just so you know a little bit of historical context, the Maharal was one of the great rabbis living several centuries ago in Prague. And he, if you've been to Prague, you may have visited his synagogue. You may have heard the legend of the Golem of Prague, the Golem, right? The forerunner, some say, of a Frankenstein type character. Either way, this is from the Maharal. He was a mystic and the commentary, and he's incredible. Marnin, if you'll read this, please, text 10, page 79. I need someone to explain what he's saying. It's a very deep concept. Very deep. It's an important concept. We need to flesh it out. What's he saying? How do you understand what he's saying?
Couldn't be an option.
Why not? Why not? Why?
Because of what we are, the core of the kingdom of creation.
How? Good. Even more. Let me state this like this. The world, in this understanding, and again, this whole course is predicated, there are elements of faith and belief in this course, right? We're working with a belief in God, we're working with a belief in Torah, etc. This is going to be another element of faith, but this is what this belief is. God created the world for a purpose, and Torah outlines that purpose. Torah tells us the reason why the world was created and the way the world is meant to look like. And if it doesn't, then what's the purpose of all of this? Creation, the world, human beings, the universe, there's no point. It's created for a mission, for a specific purpose. If that purpose is not being fulfilled, if that purpose is not even known, if that purpose is not being embraced, then what is the purpose? There's nothing left. In other words, this really is derived from a classic teaching of our sages that says the Torah existed prior to the world. It says like Alpayim Shana Kadma Torah Lolam. It says Torah preceded the world by 2,000 years. Yeah, before the world, there was no time and space. I had to get 2,000 years. Whatever, go figure. But the point is like this. Torah precedes the world. It's not like you have a world and things exist and then it's like, you know what, you might as well do this once you're here. No. Torah is the design. This is what it's meant to look like, which means that God was trying to make a statement at Sinai. And that is, I asked you if you wanted it and you said yes. But here's what you need to know. Your relationship with Torah is not just, I chose it, at some point I can unchoose it, it's optional. That's not what Torah is. Torah is not optional. Torah is essential. Torah is at the core of the purpose of creation. Now, we still have freedom of choice is still granted to human beings. You and I have choices every moment of the day to do whatever we want. But God's statement is, at its core, Torah is not objectively optional. In other words, Torah is the purpose of mankind, the purpose of creation. So God is saying this is necessary. And if you're not going to embrace it, if the entire Jewish nation says, you know what, we decided not to, then God's like, all right, so I guess we'll just fold up this whole thing because there's no point. The best, and give me a second, the best way I can, one of the examples that I can use, and this is an example, an analogy that the Rebbe gave in the 1960s, is regarding the space mission. You take an astronaut. Oh, by the way, this answers the other questions. Why can't we alter it? Why can't we abolish it? What do you mean alter or abolish it? Because this is the design. What are you going to alter or abolish the design? This is the way it's meant to be. The example that's given, that the Rebbe gave, was about an astronaut. Imagine you train an astronaut. Imagine you are NASA, which is kind of weird because NASA is a thing, not a person, but whatever. Work with me. You're heading up NASA. And you need to train an astronaut. When you train an astronaut, you tell the astronaut what to wear, what to eat, when to wake up, what to do when you wake up, what the mission is, right? Et cetera, et cetera. You define every minute of that person's day. It's defined by someone else. And then you're trained. You're given instructions and you're trained. And then you're sent on a mission. Imagine the astronaut gets up into space and says, you know what? Not interested in the mission. Not interested. I'm going to take off this suit. I'm just going to go float around a little bit. Oh, those buttons, I'm going to choose which ones I press and which ones I don't press. I'm going to be the one to choose. How's that going to work out?
Same for the military, though.
Same for the military, right? Same for the military. Yeah, this example is one that the Rebbe gave in the 60s when the whole, you know, space thing was cool. It's still cool today, but I'm saying when it was like at the height of, or it was a thing in popular discussion. So here's the point. The point is that there's a mission. There's a mission. And NASA would say, look, if you're not going to do the mission, right, if this is not, we're not just sending you into space for no reason. There's a reason why you're being sent there. It's either to gather something and to analyze it or to fix something that's broken or to whatever it is, but you're being sent for a mission. There's a purpose here. Once we understand that there's a purpose, now we understand why there are guidelines. Because for every purpose, to achieve a purpose, you have to have guidelines. You have to have parameters. That's the way it works. Understood in this light, the details of Torah that are so different than American law, it all makes sense. Number one, God needs to make a statement to us that this is really important. It's not just really important. It's not just nice. It's not just good. It's not just beneficial. But it's essentially important. It's at the core of existence. And God delivers that message, the way the Maharal understands it in text 10, by lifting the mountain over our heads and saying, this is really important. And if not, then there's no reason. It's not only you'll be buried here, but really, as the Maharal explains it, nothing ought to exist. There's no reason for this to exist if we're not achieving purpose. And now we understand again, as I mentioned very quickly before, why Torah tells us in Deuteronomy that these laws cannot be altered and cannot be abolished. Because when you talk about human laws, okay, human laws are human laws, alter and abolish. But this is the divine design of the universe. These laws are moving people, mankind, and moving the universe and the world to its desired state. That's a big deal, and that's something that has an objective look to it, the way at least we believe, the way we understand it, God's design of how this should look and how this needs to look. So God says, these are the things that are going to make you achieve your destiny and the world and the universe achieve its destiny. You want to alter it? You want to abolish it? But what about the mission? You want to change the mission? What do you mean change the mission? This is the mission. This is the destiny. This is where we're going. Again, free choice is not taken away, but this is understanding the context of what Torah law is and why it looks the way it looks. Does this make sense? Sort of?
Yes?
Yes? Except for?
Except for what if he dropped the mountain on the Jews and the Egyptians still existed and the other tribes that didn't accept it?
Here's the thing. God knew that we would accept it because we already said we would accept it. Right? We already said that. God knew we were in. God wasn't trying to scare, according to the Maral. God was trying to impress upon them and upon us the critical importance of what it is that we accepted, that we shouldn't believe that its entire validity is because we accepted it, but rather because this is critically important. That's the mindset shift. It's not just something that I accepted, because if I accepted it, I can unaccept it. So God's like, I want this to move away from, the conversation needs to move away from this personal choice thing, although you did choose it, which is great. You, the Jewish people, did choose it, which is awesome. But it has to be much bigger than just choice. It has to be objective reality and purpose and destiny, and this is what achieves that. It's like NASA that tells the astronaut, look, when you get there, and you get out of your craft and you go to the International Space Station, right? You need to press these buttons in this sequence to make something happen. Can you alter it or abolish it? You do whatever you want once you're up there. Of course, free choice is granted. But that doesn't mean that the rules or the mission should be altered. The mission is the mission. Again, we're all working on this, right? No one's a perfect astronaut. We're all working on it. But the point is that understood in this context, Torah law is not just a law, not just a rule book like any other law, man-made law, which is basically things are operating a certain way, we don't like it or we do like it, so let's put rules to keep us in check or whatever it is. It's not what Torah law is. Torah law is, the best way I can phrase it is like this. Torah law steps in after U.S. law. Once we have our freedoms and our rights, and we don't have anyone telling us how to worship, who to worship, where to worship, you are free to live your life. Now Torah comes in and says, you're free to live your life. This is the best way to live. These are the best things to do. This is going to make you happier, more self-fulfilled, and make the world a better place. What could be wrong with that? So again, understood in this context, each system of law and governance serves its purpose in its context. American law keeps our freedoms intact. But the question is, what do you do with your freedoms? Freedom without direction quickly devolves into something ugly. Listen, I've been to places where you have people that have recently been granted certain freedoms and rights, but without direction, it devolves into chaos and anarchy. That's the reality. When God said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and deliver Pharaoh a message, what was the message? Let my
people go.
What's the rest of the statement?
People.
No. What's the rest of the statement after that?
Right?
No one knows it.
Oh.
God said to Moses, tell Pharaoh, let my people go so that they may serve me on that mountain. We all love the first half.
Oh.
Because it aligns with human rights. And we love that. Let my people go. Moses was a human rights advocate. You know what the second half of the statement was? So that they may serve me on the mountain, Mount Sinai, by embracing Torah and Mitzvah. Why? What does it mean? Freedom without direction quickly devolves into chaos. You tell a child, do whatever you want. Is it always going to be healthy? Of course not. So freedom. So step one, American law, freedoms, personal human rights. That's fantastic. We can be who we want. We can choose whatever we want. Then Torah comes in and says, now that you have the ability to choose, choose the best. Choose to live a life that's going to lift you up and lift everyone up around you. As we said last week, every mitzvah is a personal benefit to us and of collective benefit to the entire universe. And so this is how we are going to end today's discussion. by understanding that although the two systems seem to be opposites, and in many ways they are, understand that they're opposites because they're trying to achieve different objectives, but they can coexist together. American system of governance and law tells us people stay out, government stay out, allow me to be who I want to be. And Torah tells us the best way to be, in the understanding of, obviously, in the Jewish understanding of the best way to be. So here we go. In conclusion, Torah should not be, Jewish law should not be misconstrued as not caring about the individual, not caring about each and every one of us individually, and only looking at the bigger picture. This is a mission from God. You got to be on board, like the astronaut, sacrifice your own person. No. Judaism also believes in the individual. In fact, there's a quote from the Talmud that we have in the text that we're not going to read that says that everyone must say, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, the world is created for my sake individually. And Judaism empowers the individual, but empowers the individual to recognize the responsibility that lies on our individual shoulders. Only we can make ourselves a mensch. When God said, let us make man, you know who the us was? You. God says, let us make man. You're the other party. Man is a mensch. God doesn't make us a mensch. God starts us off and we make ourselves a mensch. So here we have it. It's our individual responsibility to make ourselves a mensch and make the world a menschier place. This is at the core of Judaism. This is at the core of Torah law. You and I are the ones to do it. Torah shows us how the world is depending on it. Let's get moving. Thank you very much for joining me today for lesson number 3 of Wrestling with Faith.